You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Japan's engagement with Africa. My name is Mireya Solis, and I'm the holder of the Knight Chair in Japan Studies at the Center for East Asia Policy Studies. And today's program represents a collaboration with the African Growth Initiative and my colleague, Senior Fellow Amadusi. I want to take just a couple of minutes to introduce some of the themes that we'll be covering in today's event. I would like to start by noting that Africa is a continent of great promise. The region has made great strides in improving governance and economic management, has witnessed the expansion of the middle class, and some areas of the continent are experiencing very fast growth. I think it's very interesting to note that this year, the projected growth rate of sub-Saharan Africa at 6% means that this is the world's second most dynamic region in the world. Now, many donor nations have noticed these trends and have stepped up their engagement with the region in ways that go beyond traditional aid and humanitarian efforts to emphasize more public-private partnerships and a greater role for private entrepreneurship. In this context, one of the main objectives for our program today is to understand how one of the world's largest donors, Japan, is rethinking, recalibrating its aid approach to Africa. And I first should note that Japan's involvement with African development is certainly not new. If you think about one of the main vehicles for this interaction between Japan and Africa, and I have in mind the Tokyo International Conference on African Development, or TICAD, well, this meeting has been taking place for the past 20 years. So Japan's commitment to Africa development is longstanding. But there are very interesting new policy departures that we want to discuss today. One is, of course, that last year, TICAD 5, there was a new priority, new emphasis on really bringing on board in a much more systematic and direct manner the private sector. And I think it's also interesting to note that even though over the years, over the past 15 years or so, Japan's foreign aid budgets have decreased, the share that goes to Africa actually has grown. So we want to understand what place does Africa play in Japan's aid policy, and to what extent it can realize these new policy departures. Let me walk you very briefly over the different panels that we'll have today. The first panel is going to try to understand in much more depth in which ways Japan is reconfiguring its approach to Africa, and what are the opportunities and challenges to realize this new vision of involving more the private sector. As we move into the second panel, we will engage in a broader comparative discussion of the ways in which different donors, Japan, the United States, and China, are stepping up their engagement with the continent, and to what extent can African policymakers tap on this opportunity to promote their own development goals. And finally, we're very honored and excited that Ambassador Okamura will provide the closing keynote this afternoon. I should note that the ambassador is traveling to Washington just for the specific purpose of addressing this audience. And I think we're all very grateful that he'll come straight from the airport today to be able to give his keynote this afternoon. So let me just briefly introduce our panelists for the first session. It is really a stellar lineup. We're very grateful to all of them for agreeing to participate today. Hiroshi Kato is Vice President of the Japan International Cooperation Agency and Director of JICA's Research Institute. He joined JICA in 1978, has served in many different capacities within JICA, and as you know, this is Japan's premier agency behind the foreign aid program, and he at some point was in assignment in the Ivory Coast. Ms. Keiko Honda is the Executive Vice President of the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, or MIGA, which is the political risk insurance and credit enhancement arm of the World Bank Group. Prior to joining MIGA, Ms. Honda was the first woman that became senior partner in Asia at McKinsey & Company. Amadou Si is Senior Fellow at the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative. And before joining Brookings, Amadou worked for 15 years at the IMF, and his research focuses on banking, capital markets, and macroeconomics in Africa and emerging markets. And Mr. Satohiro Akimoto is Senior Vice President and General Manager of Global Relations Department at the Mitsubishi Corporation, and his work focuses on geopolitical and economic research and intelligence, and in this capacity, he travels with regularity to Africa. Just before coming to this panel, he was telling me he had just been in Nigeria a couple of weeks ago. So without further ado, we're going to start our discussion today, and I'll ask Vice President Kato to get us started. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Miria, for the introduction. It's indeed a great pleasure to be here to have an opportunity to talk about JICA, or Japan's policy toward Africa. The purpose of my talk is threefold. The first is to look back on Japan's engagement in Africa, talking primarily on the TICAD process, which started, as Miria said, in 1993. A second, I'd like to touch on the discussions that took place last year when the TICAD 5 conference was held June last year. And thirdly, I'd like to share with you some of my views on the effective approaches which I think, or we think, might be effective and useful for the promotion of inclusive development in Africa driven by the private sector. Now, the first point, I'd like to talk about the TICAD process. Japan's engagement in Africa cannot be discussed without referring to the process of the Tokyo International Conference on International Development. And in fact, I believe that the biggest contribution of the Japanese government toward African development in the last 20 years or so might be that it initiated the process of a TICAD and made it functional over the years. At that time, in 1993, Japan was the world's top donor. Now it is the fourth biggest donor, but it was the largest donor during the 1990s. And it started this TICAD process in 1993 while Japan was the top donor, whilst what they called the aid fatigue was rampant among other donors, like in Europe or in the United States. So I view that this initiative of the Japanese government to start the TICAD process was aimed at fulfilling its responsibility as the then top donor. From the very beginning, the process of TICAD advocated the importance of several important principles, like self-help or ownership of the development process by the African states, or partnership between Africa and the global community. These principles may sound obvious from our ears today, but none of these concepts was so common at that time in early 1990s when the policy prescriptions of the structural adjustment was very dominant. And perhaps reflecting the view of the Japanese government, which, in my view, was never totally comfortable with the Washington Consensus of Development, one of the conferences highlighted the role of the government to be played in leading development. And another salient feature of the series of conferences was the emphasis of mutual learning between different regions, especially between Asia and Africa. Through its 20-year history, the TICAD process has brought forth a number of practical outcomes. NEPAD, or the New Partnership for African Development, was a brainchild of the process of TICAD. Also, there emerged two important continent-wide policy frameworks from the TICAD process. One is the Program of Infrastructure Development in Africa, PIDA, and the other, Comprehensive African Agricultural Development Program, or CADAP. And TICAD 5 last year came up with the Yokohama Action Plan, which compiles 617 specific action plans proposed by 57 countries and organizations. And the progress of these, each one of these specific action plans is going to be monitored by various mechanisms, including the annual ministerial meetings. Organized jointly by the Japanese government, the World Bank, the UNDP, the UN, and African Union Commission, this process, the TICAD process, has grown into an open forum, a forum open not only to Japan and African states, but also to other actors, such as developed countries other than Japan, and private sector, and civil society, and international or philanthropic organizations. And this is a unique feature of the TICAD process, which not is often seen in any similar-looking conferences organized by other actors, which are essentially bilateral in nature. Let me now turn to the second point and talk about the recent development, especially what happened during the TICAD 5 conference last year. In my view, the last year's conference made a clear break with the traditional scope of African development. Until then, TICAD conferences, honestly, were primarily a place for discussing the traditional forms of foreign aid. At the conference, Mr. Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister of Japan, highlighted that what Africa needs now is private sector investment and public-private partnership leverages that investment. He also urged the private sector of Japan to invest more in Africa, saying that Japan needs Africa to grow. So I think it is a kind of Copernican change of mindset. Before that, maybe the mindset was, you know, if you need Japanese aid, please, African states, to come to Japan for discussion on aid. But what Mr. Abe said is that he clearly stated Japan needs Africa for it to grow. So it is a Copernican, in my view, change of mindset vis-à-vis African continent. Those strong statements from the top leader of Japan can be explained, as I see it, by two factors, both from Africa and from Japan. The African factor that must have been in Mr. Abe's mind was obviously robust growth rates, as Miria said, greater than 5% of Africa since the early 2000s. In addition, Japanese leaders have often heard from the African leaders that while they appreciate the foreign aid of Japanese government, what they really need is investment from the Japanese private sector. As I view it, however, that is not the only reason for Mr. Abe's strong statement. I believe that in addition to the pulling factor from the African side, there was a pushing factor that came within the Japanese economic and social conditions. As part of its Abenomics economics policy, reinvigorating the private sector of Japan was at the top of his policy agenda, or Mr. Abe's agenda. And encouraging Japanese firms, which hitherto had tended to be complacent to dealing with the mature Japanese market, to explore new frontiers, including Africa, was one of the key priority orientations of the current government. So the TICAD 5 conference was held when there were enthusiasm both on the African side and on the Japanese side. And it is important to keep this enthusiasm alive and going in the years to come or in the decades to come. And for that, I believe ODA can play an important role. And this belief of mine leads to my third point, and that is how should ODA be used to promote inclusive development in Africa driven by the private sector. Obviously, there are several fundamentally important factors for any conditions for the private sector activities to thrive in any country. And that is, one of them is obviously infrastructure. And it is based on this conviction that the Japanese government committed support to African growth over the next 5 years up to $32 billion, of which $6.5 billion would be allocated for infrastructure development. I must admit, however, that compared to the vast financial resources needed for infrastructure development in Africa, this amount of money, $32 billion or $6.5 billion offered by the Japanese government, will be a tiny bit, and it alone will not, you know, satisfy the needs of the African infrastructure development. However, if used wisely and strategically, I believe that ODA can be an effective tool for infrastructure and development and private sector development. Here I have 2 points. First, infrastructure development must emphasize the regional integration, both within countries or across national borders. This is imperative given the need for inclusive development through which all the countries on the continent and all the people living there must enjoy the fruit of the of development. Infrastructure development, therefore, must be promoted with a regional perspective in mind, and that is why the Japanese government is promoting strongly what they call international corridor projects as its pillar of cooperation. And also being promoted in this context by Japan is one-stop border post project, which aims to reduce various costs associated with border transaction, cross-border transactions. From the very beginning, and second, an infrastructure development must be comprehensive and go in hand with a variety of development projects, including manufacturing, agriculture, and natural resource development. To realize such a comprehensive development, it is useful, or I would even go so far as to say necessary, to have a long-term comprehensive vision of development or master plans. The idea is that by preparing these master plans, governments can share the vision of development with various actors, such as external donors, domestic and foreign private companies, and people living in the region. And public resources to be provided through ODA could support governments to work out these master plans and any accompanying documents such as feasibility studies. Public-private partnership can happen in a variety of ways at various levels, but it can be more effective if it is promoted based on the shared vision of development, such as the one provided by a master plan. Actually, this is what Japan has been doing in Asia since the 1980s. Though I fully recognize that there is a vast difference between Asia and Africa, I still believe that these approaches that have been proven effective, tested and proven effective in Asia, are worth trying in Africa, in the spirit of the TICAD process, which emphasized the mutual learning between Asia and Africa. Thank you very much for your attention.
Ms. Honda is going to come next, and because she's going to use PowerPoint, I'll ask all the panelists if we can just step down for a few minutes so we don't have the lights in our eyes, and then we'll come back right after her presentation.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to discuss Japan and investment. Two topics that steal my heart. I make my remarks from the vantage point of MIGA. MIGA is the part of the World Bank Group, provides political risk insurance and credit enhancement for the private investors. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Kato, to emphasize the importance of the private investors. Well, let's start looking at the Japanese foreign direct investment. This chart shows the cumulative FDI from Japan to the rest of the world. As you can see, largest investment destination is United States of America, which occupies 28%. Then China, Netherlands, Australia, and UK, and Brazil. Only 1% went to Africa, including South Africa as well as rest of Africa. This trend continued in 2010 and 12. The next chart shows the net cumulative investment between 2010 and 2012 to the developing world. Number one among the developing world destination is China, then Brazil, Thailand, Indonesia, India, but again, it's not that much still going into Africa. Africa aggregated number is $1.8 billion. Then we kind of projected and looking at each of the countries, among the Africa, South Africa is the largest because of the shipping industry effect. Liberia, it looks big. But again, it's relatively small money is at this moment so far went to Africa. Then we looked at how we are doing in MEGA. Left-hand side shows MEGA's regional support for Japanese clients. Majority went to Asia Pacific, then in Latin America, Caribbean, Middle East. Very small portions are going into Africa. So this is consistent. Even with MEGA support, Japanese private investors not necessarily having a large portion of the money spending in Africa. But I just like to highlight to you, is this really the same for the rest of the world? I must say, European, especially French, as well as Americans, are increasing the investment activities in Africa. Among the MEGA support last 4 years, Africa is getting more and more popular. It's getting more and more popular destination. As a matter of fact, last fiscal year 13, finished end of the June 2013, because World Bank's fiscal year starts July and ends June. So the last fiscal year 13, 54% of a guarantee was extended for the investment in sub-Saharan Africa. What kind of project are we supporting? Let me start with the Côte d'Ivoire, where, if my memory is correct, Mr. Kato stationed before. Okay, long time ago. I had an opportunity to visit last year. We're supporting bridge, power plants. And Djibouti, we're supporting container terminal. Then Zambia, as well as Ghana, we also have some support going on. But unfortunately, those five projects, I have not seen any Japanese investors or EPC contractors. But I must say, one kind of spotlight is now shed in Kenya. Kenya, we have been serving the Ocarina Geothermal Power Plant. This is actually a wonderful investment. First of all, it's a geothermal. It's environmental friendly. Also, this geothermal power plant operator decided to extend the power at relatively reasonable cost to the people nearby. So they started to building a flower garden to export roses and other European flowers to Netherlands. This Ocarina Geothermal Power Plant has an expansion plan where I'm hearing a lot of interest from Japan, especially Japanese trading company. So I see some rights, but I think at this moment, the light is still small. then we thought about it, what is kind of the good reasons for private investors to go to Africa right now? I can think of three reasons. First one, as Malia pointed out, Africa is one of the highest growing region. Some people may say average rate of 5% is not really high. However, given the recent global economic growth, which World Bank just announced yesterday, it's actually about half of this one. So 5% growth last entire decade, and also we're forecasting the similar growth in near future. This is, I must say, this is high growth. Also high returns. 2010 UN estimation about the US FDI in Africa, return on investment was 20%. Compared to the 14% of Latin America, 15% of Asia, again, I must say this is a high return. So Africa is one of the fastest growing country, at the same time provides the highest return. And second of all, there is a need for the investment, especially infrastructure. That is stated again by Mr. Kato as well as Maria. This is really true. You probably know this one really well. Then I'd like to add one more interesting point, which is Japan can add a lot of value. Serving for Japanese clients more than 25 years as a consultant, I found operational and maintenance expertise of Japanese company is a superb. This can be used in Africa. Let me share World Bank Group's analysis. This is a little old. We announced 2008. But this, I believe, still actually holds somewhat true. 2008 in Africa, World Bank estimated funding needs of the infrastructure is about $93 billion. At that time, $45 billion has already financed, so therefore it's done. By the way, among those $45 billion, 25% was financed by the private investors. Well, most of the people calculate financing gap by 93 minus 45. However, we found one more gap between a financing gap and which is called efficiency. If we improve the efficiency, for example, increasing the capacity of the power plants, reducing the loss of the power transmissions, we can use those $45 billion more. Based on World Bank's calculation, efficiency gap in 2008 was $17 billion. I strongly believe Japanese companies are well positioned to achieve or support to achieve to fulfill those efficiency gap. Well, thank you again for inviting me to be a part of this panel, then I looking forward to have more discussion after this. Thank you.
Thank you, Madhu. So, yeah, you're next.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I have to thank Maria and all the guests for coming from so far for this, and also my colleagues here at Brookings who've been working very hard. I will just go briefly. We have heard this Africa Rising narrative from the two previous speakers. So going forward, economic project growth in Africa is projected to be about 6%, and seven of the world's fastest 10 economies in 2011 to 2015 will be from the region. But it's good maybe to put this growth in perspective, and countries in Asia and in Latin America provide a good benchmark. So if you take the GDP per capita of Africa in 1970 and that of Asia and index everything at 100 in 1970, now we are at about 530 for this peer group. And for Africa, we are only at about 170. So if you think about convergence, Africa has picked up only about 10 years ago, around 2001, where other countries have started their growth much earlier. And although we're growing very fast, there's a big gap. So we need to grow even faster. We need more growth, and we need a better quality of growth. Because this Africa rising narrative should not mask the remaining challenges of the continent. There's insufficient job creation. We haven't yet reduced inequality as much as we could. Progress has been uneven. Agriculture is really beyond its potential in Africa. We have deindustrialized since our independence. And the role of natural resources with these new discoveries might even be even more important. And we all know the challenges that natural resource wealth entail. So that's the first point. African policymakers are aware of this, and there is right now a consensus about a transformation agenda, or if you will, a convergence agenda. And in this objective to transform our African economies, infrastructure plays a big role, private sector plays a big role, so do agriculture and creating jobs. Okay, second point I would like to make is that donor engagement, and I thank my colleague Lawrence Chandy for pointing that to me, donor engagement in general with the continent is not growing all that much. But there's a growing interest in the use of aid to support private sector. So, and this. So in 2005 at the Glen Eagles Summit, there was this commitment, this pledge to increase aid by $50 billion, half of which was supposed to go to African countries. But aid only increased by $30 billion, and only $11 billion went to African countries. And more recently, aid flows have gone down. So these are OECD figures. And if you look at non-OECD figures, and here I have to quote Mr. Kato's institution, the JICA Research Institute, who had just a report on Chinese aid, non-OECD aid is increasing, and Chinese aid is also increasing. It's probably driving it. So the good news is that there is a lot of thinking right now, and we have, I think, more questions than answers, but there's a lot of thinking about what should be the role of the private sector in this architecture, in this new aid architecture. As a note, as Africa consolidates its macroeconomic fundamentals and improve governance, which are some of the key drivers of the growth that we have seen, many countries can aspire to attract foreign investment, and it's happening. So actually, with a colleague of mine who's here, we have been looking at data, FDI data by country, all over Africa by different categories. And we find that if you look at the 2001 to 2012 period, you have 14 African countries in which FDI flows are higher than ODA flows. And this is compared to eight countries in the 1990 to 2000 decade. So countries are attracting more FDI, but it goes mostly to the natural resource sector, extractive, oil, gas, diamonds, and so on. Now, an interesting fact, again, that mirror what is happening on the ODA front is that a lot of the dynamism that we see is driven by non-OECD country. Again, China, but also other BRICS. So these countries account now for more than one quarter of capital investment to Africa, and this trend is increasing. So a key question is then, how should new growth opportunities and this Africa's transformation and convergence agenda lead changes in donor behavior and in the private sector? So, as a note, it's possible to at least aim to attain a kind of virtuous circle between FDI and growth, because as we know, good policies, including financial sector, governance, education, and maybe vocational education here is the key, and infrastructure should attract foreign investment and should also help lead to higher growth. And we can see a little bit concerns in many countries, where in spite of an increase in FDI, employment has not increased. We've seen some countries trying to come with some local content regulation, trying to see how they could have their SMEs be involved and so on. And there's this lot of talk about these global value chains and how African countries can insert themselves in these global value chains. So what do African policymakers say? So as mentioned, and here the TCAD played an important role because it provided a forum to come with development strategies, and these include this agenda of economic transformation, and it's clear that from African policymakers, there's a consensus about the role of infrastructure. You have also sectoral plans like the CADEP that Mr. Kato mentioned. You have also some sectoral plans on health, sustainable energy, and so on. And integration also is a key priority. So it's clear that African countries want more infrastructure and want more investment in those sectoral roles. There's been a push to increase domestic resources to achieve those goals, but as Mrs. Honda showed, that's not enough, right? In infrastructure, domestic resources will not be enough, and foreign investment is needed. So I think we have some kind of consensus on what we would like to do, but we are constrained by the poverty and the low fiscal revenues in these countries. What do foreign investors say? So this is a nice paradox, or interesting paradox, because there's a lot of long-term money out there. If you just take the sovereign wealth funds, you have trillions of dollars. If you take the institutional investors in the developed countries, you add another a lot of trillions of dollars. So there's a lot of money out there, which actually is patient money, long-term money, and there's a big need for long-term money in Africa. But the match is not happening. Why? When you talk to long-term to foreign investors, the key word here is governance. You cannot avoid the government in Africa. You cannot avoid state-owned enterprises in Africa, especially if you deal in infrastructure projects. And foreign investors have a certain perception of this risk, which is not conducive to investment. So the key word here is having partners like MIGA to try to mitigate these risks, but also to really think carefully about exactly the difference between the perception of risk and the real risks, and also really see what in the governance of the different stakeholders is really impeding, is really preventing the money from investing. So, for example, you could have a very good project in a country, but the foreign investor would say, well, I need a guarantee. The government would say, okay, I'll offer the guarantee, but then if it is a country under program, you have limits on non-concessional borrowings that will say, well, no, you cannot, because it would endanger your debt sustainability. So it's a complex issue, I agree, but I think that I think the key word here is governance, and what in the governance of these projects really is a constraint. So what do bilateral donors say? You have a whole spectrum, let's say from China to OECD countries, China, which will often go by itself, and you've seen lots of contracts, big contracts being signed. There's also some kind of evolution in the types of projects you see China having. You see, for example, in Guinea recently, you had a huge iron ore project with Chinalco, Rio Tinto, and the IFC, International Financial Corporation, which is part of the World Bank Group. And according to the figures, it could even double Guinea's GDP from a low base, of course. But anyway, so you could say that you have that spectrum from China changing all the way to OECD countries. And the buzzword these days is blending. We hear a lot of this word a lot from the bilateral donors, blending or leveraging the private sector to use aid more strategically or smarter, in a smarter way. So I would like to just quote here, although it's studying the Power Africa, U.S. Power Africa initiative is quite interesting also. According to the numbers I heard recently, first of all, the objective is to leverage the private sector and partner with the private sector, U.S. and African private sector, and coordinate, I think, about 12 U.S. agencies to invest only in the energy sector. And according to a high official from USAID, out of the $14 billion that have been raised recently, half come from the African private sector, or from Africa. So you have other models like aid for trade and so on. But the idea is just like, how do you use aid in a more strategic way and leverage the private sector? So I would like to also again here say that even now going forward, is it possible to also coordinate among all these partners, among Japan and China and the U.S.? And the lesson from, first of all, I think key questions, I don't have answers, but should it be the case? Because in the aid literature, there's a debate whether you should have competition or coordination. So the coordination we have seen in fragile countries. But what is better? I don't think we really have a definitive answer. But in any case, aid coordination has not worked that much. And again, my colleague Lawrence is saying it's like herding cats. It's not easy. So I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was really interesting. And then I'd like to ask Akimoto-san to give his remarks. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Maria, for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here with such distinguished fellow panelists. It's great to see some familiar faces in the room. I spent 10 years in Washington till 3 years ago that I was called back to Tokyo, and it's only brings back good memories that I have in Washington. We are here to talk about Africa from the viewpoint of Japan with the emphasis on the private sector. Mr. Kato and Ms. Honda pointed out that Japanese company activities in Africa at the low level and cumulative investment in Africa is very small. From the viewpoint of a person who are out there to make money, who are out there to increase corporate value, who are out there to protect the interest of shareholders, I must say that there's a good reason why investment remains small and Japanese company activity looks like stalling. The purpose of this meeting is to cast a positive light on the relationship between Japan and Africa, so I'll do my best in that respect. First, positive views in Africa. Let me begin by saying there are optimistic views on Africa emerging among Japanese companies. We used to see Africa, it has a great potential, but it also has lots of problems. But now, the way we see Africa has changed. Changed in the sense that despite lots of problems, it has begun to see a new era of economic growth and integration to the world economy. What's brought this perception change? First, African economy has shown bright economic performance. The average GDP growth of African countries in 2014 was 5.4% higher than the world average. The average annual GDP growth from 2003 to 2014 was 11.9%. It is well known that 7 out of 10 fastest growing economies in the world in 2013 are in Africa. Secondly, with the economic development, the standard of living has been on the upward trend. The per capita average income was roughly $800 in 1980, but now it is expected to reach $3,000 in the second half of this decade. Additionally, the population has been rapidly growing on the African continent. The total population in Africa was 1 billion in 2010, but it is expected to reach 2.4 billion in 2050. It is remarkable 4 countries on the continent now has more than 10 million middle-class people, and 6 countries in Africa has roughly over 5 million middle-class people now. The number of households with more than 5,000 annual income is 84 million in 2008, and it is expected to grow to 128 million in 2020. Thirdly, natural resources such as oil, gas, copper, diamond, platinum, ferrochrome, rare earth materials, and so on are still untapped largely in Africa due to the lack of infrastructure and finance, together with the political instability. But now, because of high commodity prices, it is expected that there will be much stronger push to develop natural resources in the future that have been left untouched. Lastly, we began to see more stable business environment in Africa. For a long time, many African countries were plagued with political instability and violent fighting, even over ethnic, religious, and economic divisions, even within national boundary. But now, many of these countries with bloody past have seen improved peaceful political environment. So business opportunities. With high economic growth, rising level of living standards, growing young population, rich natural resources, and relative political stability are combined, you must say there seems to be that the bright future is waiting for Africa. If you consider the fact that Africa accounts for 23% of the world landmass, 15% of world population, and yet it has only 3% of the world GDP, it is obvious that there's lots of room for growth. Against this backdrop, Japanese private sector companies now have renewed interest in engaging Africa in terms of business. There are roughly 400 to 450 Japanese companies operating in Africa. Roughly 30% of them are in South Africa. Because of the size of the economy, growing population, rich natural resources, and relative political stability, companies in a wide range of business of interest, such as automobile, automobile parts, natural resources, machinery, paint, general merchandise, and so on, are in South Africa. Mitsubishi Corporation is one of the Japanese companies in South Africa, and we own and operate ferrochrome mine, among other businesses that we engage in. We also have African business headquarters in Johannesburg. Having pointed out the importance of South Africa to Japanese business, it is also important to point out the fact that the Japanese company's penetration in Africa goes beyond South Africa. A number of Japanese companies are in Kenya, Tanzania, Nigeria, Mozambique, Angola, Zambia, Ghana, and so on. Mitsubishi Corporation has 12 offices on the African continent with roughly 100 employees. 30% of them are expats from Japan. Japanese companies see roughly four areas of business with high hopes in Africa. First, Japanese companies expect business development in basic infrastructure, such as roads, power, transportation, and water. It is well known that Japan is the world leader in many technologies in this infrastructure project. Secondly, Japanese companies will continue to develop natural resources. Japan is one of the resource-poor countries in the world, but has technology and some finance to help Africa in this respect. Thirdly, Japanese companies will engage themselves in retail markets and consumer goods. The size of a consumer market in Africa is expected to grow from roughly $3.5 billion in 2010 to $11 billion in 2060. However, the penetration, penetration rate of modern retail outlets remains very low in Africa. While the penetration rate of a modern retail outlet in South Africa is 55%, and that of Kenya, 35%, it is only 3% in Nigeria, the largest economy in sub-Saharan Africa. Lately, Japanese companies have great hope in automobile. Lastly, Japanese companies have great hope in automobile parts, and related services. The automobile market in Africa is expected to grow from 1.5 million units in 2011 to 2 million units in 2015. So what are the enablers? There are still many hurdles, such as political stability, instability, security, finance, collection of money, infrastructure, institution, expertise, legal framework, cost of business, risk mitigation, terrorism, disease, that must be negotiated by Japanese companies to transform business aspiration into reality. First, Japanese companies must think about public-private partnership. It is particularly important to secure public financing at the early stage of a project when the risks are high. Japanese companies can work with the Japanese government as well as international finance institutions in this respect. Of course, Keiko's MIGA or Ms. Honda's MIGA can help in the area of political mitigation as well as credit enhancement, as she said. Second, Japanese companies must have a long-term view of business in Africa. With all the future expectations, Japanese companies are still in need of experts who understand Africa, products which appeal to the African consumers, management skills which are functional in African context, and a trusted partnership with the local partners, local companies. Third, Japanese companies must align their interest with Africa's interest, particularly in the area of capacity building, such as basic education and professional training. It takes time to invest in human capital, but there are lots of young people who are eager to learn, and long-term commitment in human capacity building by Japanese company will eventually pay off. Of course, Africa needs jobs for young people who have acquired basic and professional training. Agriculture is critically important in this respect, and there must be some areas Japanese company can contribute, such as fertilizer, seeding, farming technique, and possibly GMO products. Fourthly, Japanese companies should aggressively consider M&As to accelerate their business in Africa. Toyota Tsusho has recently purchased Cefao, a French trading firm which has both geographical and industrial complementarity with Toyota Tsusho. This is a good example of a strategic M&A by a Japanese company recently. Finally, it is important to mention Prime Minister Abe's ODA policies. The current administration has an aggressive attitude to use ODA projects to cater to the interests of Japanese companies. While the primary focus of Japanese ODA has been on Asia, but Africa is becoming important. In fact, roughly one-fourth of Japanese ODA goes to Africa today. Tokyo International Conference on African Development, or TICAD 5, was held in June 2013 to strengthen ties with African nations through ODA. Prime Minister Abe announced $32 billion aid package to Africa, particularly in the area of infrastructure and the capacity building. What Japanese government should do is to participate in early planning, particularly in the support of strategic planning of the host country's major infrastructure project. It is also critically important for Japanese government to give advice or advices in the area of legal framework, custom regulations, investment climate, and environment. One area of Japanese ODA which need to be modified is the fact that the ODA projects are considered with a single country as a unit. Regionally integrated economies have been emerging in Africa, such as many infrastructure projects goes beyond the national boundaries, but Japanese ODA lacks a mechanism to address those needs. In conclusion, Africa has seen tremendous growth in the last decade. While it seems to usher in a new era, much of the growth has been largely spurred by Chinese investment in natural resources. The question is whether Africa can use the recent growth as a step to have more sustainable and equitable growth in the future. There are many areas in which Japanese private sector companies can play a role, as Japan has certainly achieved one of the most sustainable, equitable economies in the world. Japan has a great track record in promoting human security both in Japan and overseas. I am certain that the Japanese company, together with the Japanese government, can support African countries to help themselves, because they have to help themselves. In this respect, by providing support in infrastructure, human capacity, modern institutions, and job creation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Those were really terrific presentations. There is so much on the table, a very rich agenda, and just a few minutes left. And I do want to give the audience an opportunity to ask questions, so I'm going to restrain myself because I have so many questions to ask. But there are at least three or four points that I would like to bring up in trying to encourage a conversation among the panelists, and then I'll go to the audience and collect questions. Let me start by noting that, you know, traditionally Japanese ODA has been criticized. One of the early criticisms was that it was about the promotion of corporate interest, that mercantilism seemed to be a larger drive of Japanese aid giving. And Japan actually took this criticism, I think, to heart, and in many ways did achieved tremendous progress in untying its aid. But so much so that actually that many Japanese corporations felt that there was no real incentive for them to participate in this effort, that ODA was kept separate from export and FDI, and therefore they were less engaged in the process. So I wonder, Mr. Kato, now that Japan is saying that they want to promote the role of the private sector, how do you address this possible concern among some that they may see that indeed, you know, corporate interests are going to figure out very prominently in Japanese ODA, and how you achieve that right balance between having an ODA program that also maintains the private sector engaged? So that would be one first question. The second question I have, and I think it's something that we did not touch in the presentations, and I agree that the goal of these panels is not just to, you know, present the rising narrative and not take into account the many, many challenges that remain in Africa. And, of course, to also discuss the possibility that foreign direct investment can play in increasing those growth opportunities. But I think it was very interesting if we think about, well, what is the role of the African private sector? And to what extent can ODA programs, to what extent can the investment activities of foreign corporations team up with local entrepreneurs and try to achieve growth in that more inclusive way? That would be a second question. And the last question, I actually am going to use all the points that Mr. Akimoto used and ask Mr. Kato if he could reply to these suggestions as to how to move forward with ODA in the sense of thinking of ODA not just as, you know, a bilateral process, Japan versus the recipient nation, but to think about the regional economy, to try to incorporate private companies much earlier in the planning process, and all these suggestions he had about giving advice on the legal framework, custom procedures, and other regulations. Thank you. If you could please provide some short answers, then we'll move on to questions from the audience.
Okay. Thank you very much for those very difficult questions to answer. Very challenging one. I'd like to talk the first question, that is how we're going to deal with the challenge that, you know, using ODA wisely in such a way that Japanese ODA will not be criticized as a renewed mercantilism. There is no official statement. Maybe official statement is to adhere to the rules established by the OECD DAC and, or the export arrangement, export credit arrangements. But, you know, I think there are several ways to look at this problem. One is that, you know, as Mr. Akimoto was saying, that the Japanese companies see many hurdles that must be overcome before they decide to go into African market. There are the, you know, infrastructure and the human resources and many other things that can be, you know, dealt with by ODA. So not necessarily giving the contract to Japanese firms in purchasing and providing services for infrastructure, maybe ODA can be used for the general improvement of the business environment in Africa. That is a kind of generous way of looking at the ODA's use. But other people might say that if the Japanese loans and the projects implemented by Japanese loans are all won by companies of other nationalities, then that will be going to be a kind of politically sensitive question. So what we are trying to do is to strike a balance between the two conflicting interests. One is to satisfy the interests of the interested parties, interested Japanese firms, which want to win contracts, and at the same time, you know, maybe use all the resources for the general improvement of the business environment, not necessarily intending to favor or, you know, give contract to particular private firms. And I'd like to turn to the third question that Miria wants, how can ODA could play a role in facilitating the private firms' participation in Africa. As Mr. Akimoto was rightly pointing out, you know, the early planning and coordination of various projects are very important. And without having a clear vision of what's going to happen in a certain country, maybe individual Japanese firms will be quite reluctant to go into a market or country with which information is where information is very scarce. So what we did in Asia between the private sector and the public sector is that there is a kind of trust between the government and the private sector. And if the government is going to commit to a certain country, then the private sector will have a sense of security. And with supported and pushed by this sense of security, the private sector will decide to go into a certain country. And there is an interesting research finding made by a microeconomist in Japan, which found that a 1% increase in Japan's ODA is associated with a 0.7% increase in a total stock of foreign direct investment by the Japanese firms in 5 selected Asian countries. That means, you know, ODA can work as a vanguard or as an inducer for the private sector to go into a certain country. So this kind of tradition between the private sector and the public sector, I think that there is a lot of things that the ODA can do. Maybe the second question is too difficult for me to answer, so let me think about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd just like to briefly touch upon, Amelia, your second and third questions. One of the Africa's challenges, average size of the country is actually relatively small. Of course, there are some large markets like Nigeria, but there are a lot of small countries out there too. But each country has a different registrations. Obviously, some of them have a different language, currency, and so forth. So this is the challenge. Therefore, regional approach, really, I completely agree with you. This is very important. But for just one private investors, setting up something regional is quite challenging. Therefore, this is the area I feel like a multilateral developmental organization like World Bank or Africa Development Bank or IMF should be able to play the role. As a matter of fact, we just supported a private investor going into one country, generating the power, which actually distributed by the different private investor into two different countries in Africa. I think this, if this kind of thing is happening, we can free enjoy, or private investors can free enjoy the scale of economy. And second of all, role of the African investors. Yes, I think exactly this is actually one thing. Yes, South-South investment is happening, but it's not a lot. The reason is, again, I think some African investors understands one country really well, but that's not necessarily probably enough, except for maybe South Africans, possibly Nigerians. We need to think about it, you know, what kind of investors you really need to pick. At the same time, one other, this is a tip for Japanese investors particularly. Japanese investors prefer to form a joint venture with a local partner. That was the formula of success in Asia, but joint venture is not necessarily the popular way to conduct the business, not only in Africa, but in Europe as well as Americas. So we need to come up with some other way to collaborate with the African investors, either like agent or either actually having them to take a more leadership role, Japanese coming more like a technical advice or something. I do not have any one good answer to it. This is also myself who's thinking about it. But, you know, heavily relying upon joint venture scheme may not necessarily like a great way to succeed in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With my apologies to the other panelists that I cannot take any comments right now on these two questions because I do want to give the audience an opportunity to participate. Given that our time is very limited, I'm going to group the questions together. We'll start taking three and see how much we can get in terms of answers from the panelists and if there's time for a second round or not. If you can please raise your hand, wait for the microphone to arrive and identify yourself and be very concise given time constraints. This gentleman here.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. What can be done to use the internet to get more transparency in it and get people who are potential investors to see exactly what their money is going for and help in making the decisions?
Thank you. And I had a question at the back, that lady.
Hi, my name is Sakina from American University. Thank you so much for the information, informative discussion. And I was wondering, how can we make sure that all these the benefits of macroeconomic growth can trickle down to the bottom of the pyramid? Thank you.
Thank you. And one more question. Over in the back, please.
Hi, Richard America, Georgetown University. Would Mitsubishi Corporation give $20 million to one business school in Africa to make it a world-class business school?
Thank you. Now we'll take answers from the panelists. Anybody would like to comment on those questions?
Since somebody mentioned Mitsubishi, I feel like I have to say a word or two. My answer is I don't know. I pointed out lots of difficulties for Japanese private sector companies to go into Africa and do business. And that could be a well enough reason to invest in human capacity. But $20 million is a big amount of money. And sometime down the road, we may consider not just a single company, but a group of Japanese companies may be able to do that. I'll give you two examples. One is that in the late 1990s, when Japanese economy was not doing so well, visionary Japanese business leaders, including Mr. Ben Makihara, ex-chairman of Mitsubishi, Shoichiro Toyoda, chairman of Toyota, got together and raised $21 million, a pretty close amount of money, to start Asia Center at Harvard University to foster a dialogue between Harvard scholars and Asian leaders. So, you know, that could be a model to do that kind of thing sometime down the road. I mentioned Toyota Tsusho. I have no, they could be our competitors, but, you know, they've been doing a good job in Africa. And one example is that they have just started a training center to train not just car mechanics, engineers, but engineers in other machinery businesses. And they are doing a good job, and perhaps we should start doing smaller, more realistic type of training contribution to African workforce. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe just to the internet. I mean, right now, if you look at one success that Africa had, it's, you know, this mobile technology, which, I mean, everybody has a cell phone now in Africa, even the poorest villages, and apps are being developed to increase productivity. Of course, they are your old phones, and they're sending SMS, but it has a lot of potential into basically increasing governance, making sure that voices are heard, and even in the delivery of aid. For example, if I'm not mistaken, in Nigeria, to get farmers get agricultural subsidy using their mobile phone in term, you know, to check whether they have it. So I think it's happening, and with the cost of smartphones decreasing, apparently, probably we'll have smartphones costing less than $20 pretty soon, and internet penetration increasing. I mean, there's a lot of. If you look at the Africa Progress Panel report, they have a page in there showing a number of apps and innovations using mobile technology in Africa. Yeah.
Thanks. I think we have time for one more question or two. In the back, Franklin, behind you.
No worries. Hello, my name is Harjab Singh, recently graduated from Singhal University. My question has to go along the lines of aid and development. I feel like the missing point is political. Could you comment on like the political interests of the various actors? I believe China was discussed, BRICS, even, you know, besides Japan. How do we try to converge the political interests with the private sector, since that hasn't been really talked about?
One more question. Yes.
Hi, I'm Lola Day Mustafa. I'm an attorney and a consultant here in D.C. And I was wondering, what is the reason why you haven't had as much business in Nigeria, and what are your plans in the next 10 to 15 years to increase Japan's presence in Nigeria, since there's such a huge middle class in that country? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So last round of answers from the panelists. I should also note that this question of competition and coordination among donors is going to be touched upon in the next panel. Any comments from the panelists to these questions?
Will you paraphrase the question once again, please? The political interest of...
Sorry, if it wasn't clear. Well, there's a lot of discussion that reason states are taking more interest in Africa is given the power dynamics of an emerging multipolar world. And so some countries that are apparently losing influence within, say, the UN or international community feel that Africa is very pivotal, not only economically, but politically. And so there's an issue of, like, a divergence that some analysts are saying that, like, the economic interests aren't actually coordinating with the political, and so there's a lot of waste in resources.
Well, Mr. Kato is thinking about that question. I would like to say a quick word about having a partnership partnership with local companies. Keiko or Ms. Honda may be right that finding a viable, respectable local partner could be difficult in Africa. But if I paraphrase the difficulty or go into the details, Japanese companies, many of them have very high level of standard of compliance. And sometimes there's a gap between the level of compliance we have with local commercial customs. So that makes things kind of difficult. Number two, that many Asian companies, Pakistanis, Indians, Singaporeans, and others are interested in African market. And we are actually, Mitsubishi, as well as many Japanese companies, are thinking about going into Africa with Asian partners with whom we have a trusted relationship in the Asian market. Finally, I think Amadou is right that we don't have to think about this Africa and Japan in terms of a bilateral relationship only. There are many players, and China is the biggest player. And I'm not going to waste your time by going into detail, but China sent Premier Li Keqiang and Foreign Minister Wang Yi to World Economic Forum in Nigeria about a month ago, and their presence is big, and I think the relationship between China and African countries have transformed in a positive way, and we are not competing with the Chinese companies, and as a matter of fact, we feel like there are some areas that we can be partnership. We can build a partnership with the Chinese companies, and that's just something that I want to say, that we don't see this is as a zero-sum game between Japan and China or other Asian companies. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So we have come to the end of our time. I just want to make a few lunch announcements. We have food for everyone. You're very welcome to join us for the lunch. But I would like to ask you to please give a few minutes just so that the panelists can get ahead of the line to make sure that we feed them before they come back on stage. And the food is going to be on the hallway, and then the seating will be in the room right next to us. It should all be very clear. I think we've had a really interesting discussion. I think that we're just getting started. We're going to continue in the second panel. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock. And in that panel, we're going to touch more on the engagement strategies of different donor countries, that is Japan, the United States, and China. Please join me in thanking the panelists for a terrific discussion this morning.
Aid is profoundly much more important to Africa than anywhere else. The average low-income African country derives somewhere between 10 and 30% of its gross national income from donor assistance. Donors occupy a very important place in the dialogue over public policies for growth and over appropriate strategies for development. And as a result, what we've seen, of course, is focus by a number of European, Asian, and North American donors on Africa's development, and a number of different modes of engagement beginning to emerge in the region. Today, we have quite an interesting panel of three people representing, if you like, the supply side of the aid business, two scholars and a practitioner, and then one on the demand side, a former Minister of Finance and current advisor to the President of Uganda. So I think we have a nice balance. Two of our panelists are scholars. Two of them are people who have to deal with the real world. We're going to run things in a slightly different way than this morning's session, because one of our panelists wants to use PowerPoint. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce him, then ask him to come up and give his PowerPoint presentation. Then the four of us will move to the table. And because I don't like introducing people when you can't see the front of their head as opposed to the back of their head, I'll introduce the other three panelists once we get to the table. So we're going to start with Professor Katsumi Hirano, who is the chief senior researcher in the Area Studies Department at the Institute for Development Economies in Tokyo, Japan. He's a scholar on the development of sub-Saharan Africa. He's written in both English and Japanese about issues of African development. And before he joined the Institute for Developing Economies, he served in the Embassy of Japan in Zimbabwe. He served in the International Development Center. And he was a member of the staff of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation. So he comes to us with a long-standing reputation for scholarship on Japanese aid policy and Japan's engagement in Africa. Kitano-sensei, the floor is yours. There you have your audience. There we go.
Thank you so much, Professor Page. And let me talk about a basic condition which prescribed as a relationship between the Japan and Africa and Africa and East Asia in general. First, Let me explain. This graph is showing its African share in Japanese import and export. And it used to be we have the very big, relatively big portion of our trade ship with Africa is more than the current China. It means is for the East Asian type of the economic growth, is especially in the first stage, is African market is quite important. And another thing which I try to your intention is special position of South Africa, trade ship with South Africa. It's after the 1970s, this share of the Africa, our trade ship is going to decrease, but South Africa, with South Africa, is maintained the same level. And the next thing is a current stage. Now the Japan is a trade deficit with trade with Africa. So the why we keep is the trade ship maintained in South Africa is let me explain by this graph. This is a main item of the trade between Africa and Japan. As automobile export is the most important component of export ship to Africa, and the platinum import. And the platinum is used for, the, as you know, is a catalyst for the automobile exhaust gas. So the, it means as the automobile industry is sustained our trade ship with Africa. And in, nowadays, is a fuel import is increasing very rapidly. Let's explain by this graph. Is now we import is crude oil and also the natural gas from the several African countries. This increase, of course, is after the March 11th. Big earthquake and the Fukushima disaster. After Fukushima disaster, we now face with all nuclear power stations that stopped, and we definitely need is fuel for the electricity generation. So now the Japanese general trade balance is going to lead, and same situation now we are experiencing with trade with Africa. And this is export side from our side. As I said, is now we must have a lot of the fuel for the electricity generation must import from Africa. But our export is not catch up with the sort of the speed of the increase of the importation. This graph is a comparison with Japan and China. Our main export that is machinery. Transport machinery is some sort of equivalent. It's China and Japan. And Japanese transport machinery is mainly composed of the automobile, and China ones is a motorcycle. But electric machinery and the general machinery, now the Japan cannot see this back of the China. China is much, much bigger than. And it means is China's very energetic exportability and also the lack of the exportability of the Japanese economy. This kind of situation is observed not only the trade ship with Africa, but we observe the commonly and globally. Now the Abenomics and third portion of the Abenomics much expected to increase is our exportability and the profitability. And very different, but a very important aspect and relationship with Africa is food security. This graph showed as a sale import, East Asia and Africa. East Asia region, as you know, is the most populated area in the world. It means we are destined to import is food, especially in the cereal, because we don't have the enough arable land to get this cereal, especially for the meat production. So the other country, Japan, is definitely the biggest importer of the cereal. long years. It means that we are the biggest and the good, best customer for the American farmers, and China will follow us. But recently, cereal import of the Africa is catch up us, and actually is total cereal importation is 49 sub-Saharan African country exceeded to the Japanese import at the year of the 2009. And the total African import, it means including the North African country, is now touch on the 70 million tonnage. It's tremendously big. It's much higher than the East Asia and the total. So it means it's an international cereal market. It's have the structure. It's mainly supplied by the North and South America and also the Europe. And that volume was divided by the mainly East Asia and Africa. But the East Asian import is a relatively stable, but African import is growing very rapidly. So the African importation increase is the main threat for the international cereal market. It means agriculture development in Africa and the African country is also the main topic for the African development, but also it's a very big threat for the East Asian food security. And last point which I mentioned here is demographic transformation of the East Asia, very rapid one. So almost all countries in East Asia can enjoy the very high economic growth period, including our country, Japan, with a demographic bonus. But Japan already lost its demographic bonus, and now we will suffer its demographic onus. And South Korea is just now the turn around that peak, and China too. You can see it from this graph. So if same things happen in South Korea and China, East Asia as a region is suddenly lose its economic growth capacity. Almost 20 years ago, nobody can observe it, anticipated it's a sudden stop of the economic growth in Japan. So from the point which I mentioned here, our requirement to Africa, maybe the staple resource supplier to Africa, Africa be the staple resource supplier, and the food security in global dimension. But this kind of the requirement is observed not only our country, Japan. It's commonly observed and shared with China and South Korea and also is Taiwan. So the East Asian country share the, and also the East, our East Asian country share much of the similarity in the economic thought, and also the aid policy and its priority. Aid policy document in China or, for example, Japan and South Korea have some their own rhetoric, but in the basically we shared is the same phenomenon. So I think that Japan will be able to understand well China's African policy, because their policy is have a much difference to the our history, our economic cooperation policy toward Southeast Asia. Almost the same formula we shared. From that point of view, as a region, the East Asia, that is a global center for manufacturing, that have the biggest demand for the natural resources. That's kind of the characteristics we requested as is a regional-wide collaboration is the most desirable for us and definitely productive. Also is African policy. But unfortunately now you may know is East Asia region politically speaking divided by the confrontation and relatively combative nationalism. So I think this, if we have this more economic rational and rationality about this combat, about international terrorism, maybe we have this more productive African policy, East Asian regional wide. Thank you very much.
Right. Well, now we move to the panel discussion. And it's my pleasure to introduce the other three panelists, each of whom, again, will speak, I think, from the table for probably about 10 minutes. But let me introduce all of them now, and then we can very quickly move from one to the other once we begin. I'll start on my far right with Don Niss, who is the deputy coordinator for President Obama's Power Africa and Trade Africa initiatives. He sits in the United States Agency for International Development, but has the unenviable task of trying to draw resources and expertise from across the government to make the initiatives work. For those of you who've had some experience in Washington, getting anyone around the cabinet table to actually work together, I think probably he deserves some kind of a presidential award just for that. He has a long history in the private sector before coming to USAID, having worked for people like Chase Manhattan, worked for OPIC, and he spent some time at my alma mater, the World Bank, which we won't hold against him. But Don, I think, is intending to give us a bit of a perspective on the U.S. approach to Africa and also some thoughts on the coordination of donor efforts in Africa. Next to Don is Ezra Saruma, who is a former colleague of ours here in the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings. He's had a distinguished career in the public service of his country, Uganda, having at one time served as the deputy governor of the Bank of Uganda, then the Minister of Finance. He currently serves the president of Uganda as his senior advisor on finance, economic issues, economic coordination. So Ezra has a very strong basis of expertise. I don't know yet, can we make the book plug? He's written a rather interesting book on public policy making in Uganda, as time as a senior fellow here at the Brookings Africa Growth Initiative. And so I wouldn't be embarrassed if he were to make a book plug while he was giving his talk. And then to a further colleague, Yun Sun, who was visiting with us a couple of years ago here at Brookings. She is currently at the Stimson Center, where she is one of their experts on China's foreign policy toward conflict and emerging economies in Asia and Africa, and is a fascinating colleague with whom to talk because she brings some genuine insights and some perspectives for having spent time on both sides of the Pacific, I think, which will help us to get an understanding of where China is going in Africa today. So, without then further comment on the panelists, let me turn to Don and ask you if you would give us your remarks.
Sure. Thank you very much, John. I wanted to thank you and to the initiative here at Brookings for inviting us to talk about Power Africa today. What I'd like to do, we have just a brief time to sum up something that's fairly complex. So what I'd like to do is just talk to you a little bit about what Power Africa is, what the model is about, go into a little bit of detail about what the implications are for Power Africa's private sector focus, and then wrap up with a couple ideas on what the implications of all of that is for donor coordination and how that might have some impact on how Japan engages in Africa. And so Power Africa was announced almost a year ago, June 30th, by President Obama in Cape Town. And basically, the idea behind it is it's, you know, we had a number of discussions the previous year with leaders and businesses in Africa asking, what are some of the biggest impediments to your continued economic growth? At that time, 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world were in sub-Saharan Africa. I think that's now increased to 8 of the top 10 fastest growing economies. And to a T, almost everybody said to us that power was the most significant impediment to their continued economic growth. And so for USAID, we're engaged not only on economic growth issues, but we're also engaged on issues related to, you know, of development. So it also has serious implications for health, for agriculture, for education. So we took that all into consideration, and so there was a number of discussions that took place amongst the different foreign policy agencies of the United States government to figure out how could we best address this question. And so Power Africa as a model emerged. And so a couple of things that come out of this. The president announced 2 key goals, which are, one is that we are trying to add 10,000 megawatts of additional generation to the grid. And that general, the idea behind that is just to increase general availability and capacity for power generation. But the second element of it, which is really important as well, which is we also want to add another 20 million connections to the grid, which also, these are new connections, households and businesses, which is really critical because this also has to do with access. Because you can add power to the power capacity of the grid, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to address questions of access. And obviously in rural areas, that's a huge issue where access may be 15% or lower in many of these countries. So the key here is if you look at the overall need, what kind of investment is needed in sub-Saharan Africa in order to reach universal access by, say, 2030 or even 2040, the estimates range anywhere from $300 billion to $1 trillion. That obviously is well in excess of what any of the donors can expect to put on the table, any of the governments themselves can put on the table. So the question came back to us is, how do you generate, how do you create the environment and the leverage for that additional gap to be bridged? And so what we said is this has to be a private sector driven initiative. So how do we focus our resources on not only getting the investment in the short term, so looking at what things can be done in terms of catalytic interventions, but also what can be done in terms of the longer term environment for private sector investment in sub-Saharan Africa? And so what we came up with is a very flexible tool that, or a framework that taps into the 12 U.S. government agencies and departments. It ranges from, obviously, the USAID, who serves as a secretariat and the interagency coordinator for the initiative, State Department, Commerce, OPIC, EXIM, Millennium Challenge Corporation, U.S. African Development Foundation. And all of these agencies have tools and resources that they can bring to the table to bring to bear to these questions of additional generation and additional access. So fundamental to this is all about partnerships and how do we work best together with not only with the private sector, with the host country governments, with other donors. And so what we did in terms of the private sector engagement is we decided to focus our efforts on 6 priority countries, 3 in East Africa and 3 in West Africa. So in West Africa, we're working with Liberia, Nigeria, and Ghana. In East Africa, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Tanzania. And what we did from there was we said, what transactions, what power projects are going on in those countries right now which have catalytic impact? And how can we get involved with them to help deal with some of the key challenges and obstacles that come up in the natural project development cycle of a power project and how that power project gets completed and brought onto the grid? And so what we did is we identified 26 priority transactions which range in size from 1 megawatt all the way up to 1,000 megawatts. And they range in technologies from we're looking at gas, we're looking at solar, geothermal, wind, solar. And the key to this is a proper mix of technologies is really critical to this. And so by looking at that mix, we also said by picking certain catalytic projects, we said, how can we set the foundation for greater investment with some of these technologies going forward? So in the case of Kenya, we've been involved with the wind project there, where the banks were concerned about the ability of the grid to be managed, because wind is intermittent. It's not blowing constantly. And so generation comes and goes. And so you really have to worry about how do you manage the grid, how you bring that electricity on. So we built capacity within the institutions that are responsible for that to help ensure that the banks felt comfortable with the risk associated with buying that electricity from the wind producer. In the case of Nigeria, we've worked closely with them on their privatization process for their energy sector, which has been tremendous, and done engaged in a certain way so that they can leverage resources from other donors like the World Bank, who are putting a large amount of resources and guarantees on the table. And then the critical part of this is, so these transactions range in size, and they range in technologies, but then we also have this question still of what do we do about access? And so there's a lot out there going on in renewables. There's a lot going on in off-grid and mini-grid work. There's a lot of great technologies out there. We don't want to crowd that out. So what we said are, what are ways that we can engage on these technologies to encourage these technologies to either be to move from a pilot stage to be scaled up, or to find new business models that make those sustainable over the long run? So these are all going to be private sector driven, but what are key ways that USAID can engage and other agencies can engage to make that happen? And so far, one of the things that we've done is we've engaged a number of impact investors. These are people who are interested in, who have already have expertise in investing in off-grid and renewable projects around the world, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And we've said to them, this is what we're thinking about. We've asked them how we might engage in the best ways to really help you advance and scale up your models to hit this 20 million connections target that we have. And we've come up with an initiative that we call Beyond the Grid, and this just got announced last week, I believe, in Addis. There was the African Energy Ministerial that the U.S. held with countries of sub-Saharan Africa and North Africa, and talked about what are key ways that we can work together on energy. But Beyond the Grid is a framework under Power Africa to really encourage these off-grid and mini-grid investments to strike a balance with some of the larger type of transactions that take place. So I'll jump now to, because of the private sector focus, how we actually operate is really unusual. It's we've had to hire a lot of people from the private sector who are used to working with private sector decision-making timelines. And understand the language that they're talking about. And so we've placed people in critical roles to help bridge that gap between governments and private sector investors so that they can help, a private sector investor can talk to a transaction advisor. This is someone that we have in each of the countries who is almost like an investment banker, but understands what the government is thinking, understands what the private sector wants to do, and then helps translate that and identify key obstacles to moving a transaction forward. The other part of this, we had to have really streamlined coordination amongst the 12 U.S. government agencies. So we've created what we call a one-stop shop, and we have an interagency working group that meets on a biweekly basis. So we have formal and informal coordination that's going on. But what that does is that means a private sector partner can come to one spot in the U.S. government and say, these are the issues that I'm working on. How can you help me address these issues? And so that helps address this short time frame that private sector decision makers are working with. The third is that we've decentralized our decision making. So the coordinator for Power Africa is based in Nairobi. So Andy Herskowitz, who's the coordinator for this and speaks for the interagency, has resources, has the authority, and has staff to help make the Power Africa initiative take place, and he can reach across the interagency. And so that's really critical as well, is this decentralization, this ability to make decisions and move forward fairly quickly. So in terms of what this means for donor coordination, real quickly, I'll just sum up. What we've looked to do in terms of our partnership, particularly with donors, is We have created a framework, but we don't have all the answers and we don't have all the resources. So really what we're about is catalyzing cooperation and coordination with other donor partners. We're working closely with the World Bank, with the African Development Bank, with a number of the bilateral donors, figuring out what are our comparative strengths, not only across the region, but in individual countries. For instance, we've worked with In Liberia, the Norwegians are particularly well-placed there to engage with us, and so we're working with them on policy issues and institutional capacity building. And then the other thing is, not reinventing the wheel. There are a number of great mechanisms in place. The African Development Bank has something called the Legal Support Fund, which helps make world-class legal expertise available to governments for negotiating deals. So that we don't need to repeat, we don't need to duplicate that type of advice. And so we've tapped into that and we've made money available to them. And so that's roughly some of the implications, and I'll look forward to answering questions as we get into that.
Thanks, Don. Now we'll travel across the Pacific and ask Yun Sun to talk a bit about China in Africa.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you for the invitation to be here. I was asked to discuss China's aid policy in Africa and the perception of a China-Japan competition in the continent. So I will focus on those two issues. And if time allows, I will try to discuss the prospect of any donor coordination between Japan and China. First of all, China's aid in Africa, in terms of the volume, Africa has been the top recipient of Chinese aid. Aid data in China is regarded as state secret. But the general description is Africa has received about 50%, so half of the cumulative aid China has provided historically. And in his most recent trip to Africa, Premier Li Keqiang promised that Africa would receive at least, if not more, than half of the aid China is to provide every year. Officially, China provides eight types of foreign aid, complete projects, goods and materials, technical cooperation, human resources development, medical assistance, emergency humanitarian aid, volunteer programs, and death relief. And China's aid to Africa covers a lot of fields, such as agriculture, education, transportation, energy, communications, and health. According to Chinese scholars, since 1956, China has provided more than 900 packages of aid projects to Africa. OECD's official development assistance is defined as concessional funding given to developing countries and to multilateral institutions primarily for the purpose of promoting welfare and economic development in the recipient country. However, China is not a member of OECD and therefore does not follow its definition or practice. The bulk of China's financing in Africa actually falls under the category of development finance, but in fact they're not aid. This fact is often acknowledged privately by Chinese government officials and analysts, although Chinese literature and media constantly blurs the distinction between the two. For example, from 2009 to 2012, China provided $10 billion in financing to Africa in the form of concessional loans. Then during President Xi Jinping's first Africa trip last year, he doubled this commitment to $20 billion from 2013 to 2015. Then last month, when Premier Li Keqiang visited Africa, this credit line is further raised to $30 billion. China's own policy actively contributes to the confusion between development finance and aid. The Chinese government encourages its government agencies and commercial entities to, quote, closely mix and combine foreign aid, direct investment, service contracts and labor cooperation, as well as foreign trade and exports. The goal is to maximize feasibility and flexibility of Chinese projects to meet local realities and demands. But it also makes it very difficult to capture which portion of the financing is or should be categorized as aid. To be clear, aid is a policy instrument for China. As Africa experts in Beijing constantly point out, the basic premise and goal of aid to Africa is to maintain and strengthen China's national interest and influence in Africa. Politically, African countries are seen as a key force to support Beijing's One China policy and its diplomatic agendas on multilateral institutions such as the UN. In the past several years, given the rising tension between U.S. and China and in China's neighborhood, Africa is further emphasized as an important partner to broaden China's strategic space. Economically, aid helps to expand China's commercial interests as China frequently provides low-interest loans to nations who rely on commodities such as oil and mineral resources as collateral. Furthermore, China's capital flows into Africa also creates business opportunities for Chinese contractors, especially the construction companies. This is why Beijing always emphasized that China's aid to Africa is mutually beneficial instead of just a one-sided contribution to Africa's development. The political and economic agendas of China's aid to Africa sometimes create internal problems in China because aid is managed through the Ministry of Commerce rather than the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So for the foreign policy folks, they see aid as a political instrument, and aid decisions should first of all serve China's political aspiration. Economic benefits associated with aid projects, such as profitability, resource extraction, and the acquisition of service contracts in Africa for Chinese vendors, should be secondary. But trade promoters, such as the Ministry of Commerce, have rather opposite perspective. In their view, foreign aid serves China's overall national priority, which by definition is economic growth. Therefore, they would argue that all aspects of aid decisions in China should reflect broader economic considerations. Under this logic, the inclination is to allocate aid budget toward countries that offer China the greatest commercial opportunities. This internal conflict of China's aid policy is yet to be addressed. Then on China and Japan in Africa, starting with Prime Minister Abe's 2013 announcement of $32 billion aid to Africa, there has been a strong tendency in the media and in the policy community to portray a Japan-China competition in Africa. Such speculations peaked earlier this year when Chinese Foreign Minister and Prime Minister Abe visited Africa both in January, and some of their destinations overlapped. Given the deterioration of China-Japan relations, such speculations are understandable, although I personally do not subscribe to the theory. Africa is important for China, with or without Japan, and China has had a long-standing relationship with Africa, regardless of Japanese interests or presence on the continent. At the same time, Africa is also important for Japan for its own merits. To portray a contentious, competitive, and zero-sum relationship wherever China and Japan have overlapping interests is not helpful for the bilateral relations, and it's not necessarily helpful for the African countries either. The Chinese-Africa policy community has certainly noticed this perception of a rising competition in Africa. However, the general response to it is that the Chinese analysts and officials do not seem to feel as agitated or threatened as the media has portrayed them to be. Chinese analysts have compared the volume of trade and investment between China-Africa and between Japan and Africa, and they draw the conclusion that Japan is left quite far behind. For example, there are public research reports saying that Japan's trade with Africa was around $30 billion a year, while Sino-Africa trade last year was $200 billion. And China's investment in Africa also is believed to exceed that of Japan significantly. Politically, the Chinese feel that China has invested heavily in the friendly political ties with Africa for decades, while such strategic investment by Japan historically seems to be lacking. At the same time, China also acknowledges that Japan does enjoy certain advantage over China in Africa, such as a good reputation of Japanese products, a positive national image, and rich experience in dealing with local communities. Therefore, the concern in China about Japanese competition in Africa with China mostly focuses on the soft power issues. As for the coordination, the donor coordination between China and Japan, the issue is yet to gain major attention from the Chinese policy community. It is pointed out that there are a lot of similarities between Chinese and Japanese activities in Africa, such as the government-sponsored or government-supported trade and investment campaigns, and the development financing provided to Africa by both Japan and China have the tendency to be tied to their own economic interests. Viewing from Africa's perspective, China and Japan certainly have shared interests in Africa. These would include the peace and stability issues as well as the economic development. And Africa might aspire for China and Japan to work together, using their comparative advantages to advance and contribute to the continent's growth. However, when we examine the individual motivations of China and Japan, they would suggest more of a competition rather than cooperation. For example, both China and Japan are interested in local economic opportunities, providing tide aid, as well as gaining strategic influence in Africa. China has been particularly wary of Japan trying to gain Africa's support for its bidding for the permanent membership of the UN Security Council. The issue might be less of a concern for Beijing now, but still, given the broader context of the Sino-Japan relations, any discussion between China and Japan on major economic or political cooperation or donor coordination in Africa is going to be difficult. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Yun. And now, as I said, we switch to the other side of the table, and we'll ask Ezra Saruma to give us a perspective from the recipient side, I hope.
Thank you very much, Professor Page. I'd like to comment on five issues briefly concerning the topic that was given to me of possible donor coordination strategies. First, I'd like to comment on the historical context of aid among the three countries, China, Japan, and the United States. Then I'd like to comment about the values, common values that are shared between these various countries and Africa. I'd like to say a word about the complexity of aid and the need for aid simplification. And then I'll talk about donor coordination and the importance of governance and stability in Africa. First, the historical context. I think it's important to be clear that aid is not starting today. It has a historical context. The relationships between Africa and various donors have been going on for quite some time. And I must say that in the case of China, it has a long history, going back more than 50 years, of assistance to African liberation struggles. And it's well known that China's policy is one of non-interference in Africa's politics, which makes it very attractive to many African governments, of course. And so I think there is a history of consistency on the part of China, policy consistency, assisting in liberation struggles without interfering in the governance issues of Africans. In other words, accommodating Africa's needs. Now, with respect to Japan, we have a long history of trade with Japan. Even as a child in the 1950s, I do remember some specific textiles we used to have from Japan, even when we were still a colonial country. Japan has been largely silent in Africa's liberation struggles, but it has, of course, known that it has never been a colonial power in Africa and has generally not been involved in Africa's struggles on the domination side. In the case of the USA, I think it is fair to say that the United States is very well known for its interference in African politics, notably in Democratic Republic of Congo, in South Africa, sometimes on the good side, sometimes on the not so good side. But the USA has a reputation of human relationships with Africans that go back a long way, particularly in areas of education, where many Africans come to USA to study. And through the Peace Corps, they have contributed a great deal in education in Africa. So there is a great deal of empathy in this regard between the USA and Africa. And common values, I think that this long-standing relationship with China of anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism is important and is well regarded by Africans when they are communicating with the Chinese. It's known that they have been there and probably will be there in time of need. With Japan, trade, neutrality, a non-colonial past is always in front of us. When we talk to the Japanese, we are open-minded, we respect each other, and we feel that they are not engaging in any backhand political issues, that they mean what they say, and they say what they mean. With the USA, we share, many African countries share a common language. We speak English, official or otherwise. There is an element of Christianity that's important in many African countries. Many of us have adopted democracy aspirations, which are very much emphasized by the United States. And as I said earlier, there is a large number of African diaspora, as well as African Americans in the USA, who would be a basis for strong relations between Africa and the United States. So these, I think, are important background context within which aid takes place. It's not taking place in a vacuum, but in the context of certain relationships, historical and otherwise. Now, the issue of I want to say a word about the aid complexity and the need for simplification. Now, many announcements are made at many of these symposiums. I was participated in the Beijing Summit, Africa, Sino-Africa Summit in 2008. Big announcements were made. Big announcements have been made in Japan recently on TICAD. I also participated in TICAD in 2008. But I think what is critical is that we follow up with implementation of what is announced. And I must say that the implementation of this aid announcement is a complex matter, specifying what is to be delivered and having the African governments and African countries actually understand what has been communicated and what to expect, and then working towards delivery. These are very difficult issues. We find that in many of these agreements, there are many, many aspects that are probably not deliverable, or the deliverables are not necessarily to Africa, but to the donating country, and yet they are counted as aid. And so there is a need for simplifying the agreements and the announcements so that there is a clear understanding of what is to be delivered. The Chinese, in my view, and to a large extent the Japanese, have emphasized the visibility of aid, aid that can be seen. If I go to Uganda, I can point out to you that this complex was built by the Chinese, and this one, and so on. The USA, I think, has been less visible. It's often not easy to identify where American aid has actually gone, except in recent years, perhaps, with regard to PEPFAR, where so many thousands of people are benefiting from aid for health, for AIDS. Now, I think that one of the areas where we could benefit in this aid coordination is the aid for trade. There has been a great deal said about it, but still very little delivery. Helping Africans to access Chinese markets, Japanese markets, and American markets. And I think that, granted that there's a great deal of trade in natural resources, I think we have to look forward to a day when the natural resources will be exhausted. And if we are not aided to have other products, I think this is going to create a problem. Another area is financing. Since we are talking about private sector assistance, in my view, one of the key areas that need to be addressed in assisting African economies is financing for private enterprises in Africa. The financial sectors are still very weak, and we need assistance in financing the private sector in Africa. Now, donor coordination could perhaps be improved by each country doing what is best, what does best. We know that China has done very well on infrastructure, and Japan also is doing some infrastructure. For example, in Uganda, they're working on a bridge across the Nile, thanks to my work with them as minister. Japan has done extremely well in Uganda in delivering small-scale rice, Nerika rice. This has boosted food security in Uganda and other parts of Africa, and I hope that they will do more. And the ESA, of course, its emphasis on governance, because the long-term stability of Africa is critical to its growth. When we talk about its promise and growth, if there is no political stability, of course, nothing will come of all of this. And so I hope that the USA will continue in its efforts in governance aid. It's not very popular, but it's critical, and I hope that the other countries as well, although it's sensitive and not easy, it's necessary that some subtle assistance in stabilizing African countries continues, because the current growth we are seeing is mainly because there has been increased stability. If that is undermined in any way, I think we'll go the other way. So I hope that these efforts will continue. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I think we've had four very interesting perspectives on aid in Africa. They tell me here that I have to earn my lunch by beginning by asking a few questions of the panelists. I don't want to take too much time to do that because I want to come back to the floor, and we do need to finish by about 2:20. But one thing that struck me in almost every presentation was whether it was Hirano-sensei talking about the motivations for aid in Japan, whether it was Dr. Tsuruma talking about desired initiatives, aid and trade seem to be part of it. And Don, in fact, wears two hats, one of which is trade for Africa, I think, as well. So what I wanted to do, since we've heard Ezra's views on this, is to go back to the first three panelists, to Dr. Hirano, to Don, and to Yun, and say, how does the trade story fit into this? Is there any effort, in a sense, to have a coherence between aid policy and trade policy? And if so, are we making much progress? And is there any scope there for perhaps some collaboration? One can't help but be struck by the fact that here in America and in Europe, we have two different sets of preferences, AGOA and the Economic Partnership Agreements. They tend to work in a quite uncoordinated way. Some unkind observers of Asian economies have argued that Asia is even less forthcoming with respect to trade preferences to help developing countries. And so I'd just like to hear a bit of a reaction from each of the three panelists, starting with Dr. Hirano, and we'll just work our way down the table this way on this issue of aid and trade.
Yes, thank you. Good question. Trade, I think, is the most important thing for the development. After the Second World War, the main almost the most influential factor for the development speed is the trade, in my thought. And one thing, in concretely speaking, in the relationship with East Asia and Africa, and exemplified in the China very rapid expansion, natural resource exploitation is quite important. Someone said it's not so good things for the development. I well understand, but in the case of the China and the African government, that natural resource development is a definitely contribute to the development and promote the development of Africa, and provides a huge amount of the foreign exchange for the African nations. And that is the basement of the consumption expansion is the African economy currently. But on the other hand, is more
human resource-related trade can be observed. And we are much experienced in the East Asian region. And that is a manufacturing pastry. And nowadays, the Chinese government seem to be trying to the employment shift from the China itself to the Africa, especially in the manufacturing sector. I think it's, in the future, our nations, Japan, can assist such kind of the movement from the employment frontier in East Asia in China. And after the China development, the sort of the manufacturing can be moved to the Africa. But for that purpose, agriculture must be developed very rapidly in African continent, at least to the self-sufficient level. And the next thing is a very important one is the most potential market can be found is the African continent itself. Because now the Africa have the 55 countries, but the only one country in Zambia can enjoy its foodstuff sufficiently. But as all African country, it suffer from the deficit of the cereal importation. So it means it's only one country can sustain, can attain to the self-sufficiency of the cereal production. They can find easily to the neighboring market for that surplus cereal or the foodstuff production. So the China seems to have to put on the agricultural production, and today's session, Mr. Kato already said, is Japan long time they put in the priority our cooperation to the agricultural development. So the agricultural development is quite important. To exploit is a trade opportunity for the African countries.
You know, in terms of some of our work, I can talk briefly just about in terms of Trade Africa. It is Trade Africa for to date has been focused mainly on East Africa and focused on the EAC, the East African Community, and through a mechanism called Trademark Africa, which and a lot of it's focused on how do we facilitate trade amongst the countries of East Africa, looking at questions of critically of the transportation corridors, addressing the speed and the cost of trade and getting to key ports, since a number of those countries are landlocked. So that's been part of the issue in terms of the key issues there. We also have the trade hubs that we have working in West Africa and East Africa, largely focused on how do we help access markets, working with small businesses in those areas. Some of the work that we do helps facilitate partnerships in the same way that we do with Power Africa, in trying to draw those connections between U.S. firms and African firms as well.
Sure. In terms of the relationship between Chinese aid and Chinese trade with Africa, I would say there are primarily two things. The first one is what the Chinese term, what the Chinese slogan is called, resources for development, where the African countries use natural resources as a collateral and China provides them with infrastructure projects. Usually these projects are funded by Chinese policy banks and they're carried out by the Chinese service contractors. So it creates both export of natural resources from by Africa and service trade or service contracts for Chinese companies. I would say that China has realized the problem of that approach, and since 2-3 years ago, especially now, China is trying to diversify its relationship, its trade relationship with Africa. One of the motivation of that tendency is China itself wants to move up the global supply chain. So there's a tendency to transfer some of the manufacturing businesses and companies to Africa. At the same time, Chinese government has emphasized providing training and human resources development in Africa, and they have increased the number of fellowships for African students, African engineers to study in China as well. As for the aid coordination between China and Western countries, be it European or United States or Japan, I would say one issue is the different standards that these countries implement. China's China follows the non-interference principle, and one of its ACE policies, the principle is no strings attached. Well, there is a string attached in terms of diplomatic relations with Beijing rather than Taipei. But other than that, China would rather not to have any requirement or any interference in domestic politics or the governance issue in Africa. And that could limit the potential or the scope of cooperation with Western donors.
No, Ezra is not going to escape. As a close observer of these three major actors, China, Japan, and the United States, I wonder, Dr. Tsurumi, if you would give us just one thing you would like each of them to do more of, less of, or differently than they do currently in Uganda. Mm-hmm. What kinds of strengths, weaknesses, and behaviors would you like to see these donors change?
Thank you. I think that I would say that I am satisfied with China's contribution to our infrastructure development. And definitely I would like to see them put more money if possible. We still have many roads to do and railways to build, and pipelines and so on. But overall, I'm happy with their contribution in that regard, and I hope they will continue to do so. With regard to Japan, I think their strength has been trade, but also mainly perhaps for their own interest. I mentioned that their assistance, at least to Uganda, and I think some other African countries in agriculture, small-scale agriculture, has been very successful. They talked about one village policy some time back where they would attempt to bring methods of developing small villages. I'm not sure how far that has gone. I thought it was an exciting idea of trying to include the rural people in trade. But I would like to see more of that talk revived and more money put into it. But I think that in all these cases, as I mentioned earlier, financing for private enterprises in Africa is crucial if we are to come up. With regard to the United States, I think that there is still a problem of access to the American market. Despite AGOA, I think the aid for trade is still required. Perhaps it needs to be intensified. Perhaps a long-term issue, but again, it revolves on financing. It revolves on actually opening up with removing non-tariff barriers, and I think this applies to all of these countries, that if we can't access their markets, at the end of the day, I think the aid is intended to make us stand on our own feet. And if we are going to be on aid for decades to come, that's not good. So I hope that there will be an effort to help us to become self-sustaining in the sense of opening up our own enterprises. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tsurumi. Now I think it's time to have all of you join the conversation. May I ask just a couple of things? One, when you ask your question, would you introduce yourself first so you know who's asking the question? And secondly, what I'll try to do is take about three questions, so try to keep them reasonably short, and then come back to the panel for some responses, and people can select whether they choose to answer or not. If you have a specific question for a specific panelist, please do mention that. So let me start here.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Mariko Schmitz. First, I would like to thank Dr. Tsurumi for his comment about the Peace Corps. I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer, and in Washington, where the Peace Corps budget is always threatened, and it's taken more than 600 days for the Peace Corps to get a new director, comments such as yours, I think, help volunteers and people in Washington appreciate how much the Peace Corps does on the ground. So thank you. My question is, particularly for Donis, but also for the other panelists, could you compare the private sector relationship with Power Africa? to the types of private sector, public sector relationships in Asian, Japanese aid, Chinese aid. Thank you.
Over here.
Hi, my name is Monica Dorhoy, and I'm trying to stay here. I'm at Georgetown. I'm a professor, and I'm doing research. We are publishing in about 3 weeks an updated book on World Bank Balance Sheet 2013. And it's an update from a previous book on World Bank Balance Sheet 2012. So why should you care? It's the most extensive analysis on the investments of the World Bank Group. And I have really high marks for JICA, and I mentioned to Mr. Kato what JICA is really good at. They have real clear standards. I'm lending you this money, and I want you to achieve this. And they're really, really thorough in it. They don't lose the money, at least in the trust funds that we look at. So that's the high marks that I give to JICA. And I think you guys should support and be, you know, ambassadors for JICA because, and for this kind of work. Now, given there will be a lot of cuts in many countries, so I think you really need to be the ambassadors for agencies like this, whether you agree with the agenda or not. And, you know, John Page, I think you should really punch forward because also USAID, you know, with the Republicans going forward. So I really, really need to be aggressive going forward. That's all. So I think it's more of a message to Brookings. You really, really need to go at it because that's how you ensure. Now, again, if you look at the portfolio, there are many, many ways you can look at JICA internally and their impact. I don't want to say that, but I think your mission really is, and your legacy, to have agencies, not just agencies, but really
Excuse me,
way.
Is there a question in this?
That's all. It's a remark, and it's a long
time. So let's let some other people ask some questions. Yeah, back here. Yes, you, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Nicole Noelist. I'm a law student, and I'm also a law clerk at the EPA this summer. And Dr. Surama, you correctly stated that natural resource exploitation is finite. So my question is, have you noticed that if the African state governments who depend on natural resource manipulation or exploitation, have they been simultaneously regulating these activities to ensure environmental protection? Because my concern is after these industries leave and the environment is not sustainable for the remaining citizens and those who are there. So have you noticed that these countries, have they taken action to ensure that they are regulating the environment in a sustainable manner? Thank you.
Thanks. Let's take one more, and then I'll come back to the panel. There's a hand in the back there.
Thank you very much. My name is Ibrahim Ramey, resident of Washington, D.C. I appreciate everything that's been said. There are many concerns and considerations about human rights issues and whether or not there is a correlation between conditions for aid and the willingness of a given country to adhere to human rights protocols and agreements. So the question generally to the panel is, particularly as you look at Chinese and Japanese foreign assistance to African nations, whether or not there are human rights considerations that factor into the aid and development equation, and if so, how are they looked at, and how are they quantified?
Thanks very much. Okay, I'm going to come back to the panel then and ask them actually to think somewhat broadly. I know the question, for example, on the environment was to Ezra, but I think it would be interesting also to hear the reaction of other panelists. As part of the aid agenda, do people worry about natural resources and the environment? And indeed, as we think about climate change, is that coming on to the agenda for donors as well. So probably the easiest thing, although it's unfair to Yunus, is to start here and work our way down that way.
Sure. First of all, on the issue of human rights in Chinese aid to Africa, the Chinese definition and the perception is the biggest human rights issue is development. So in their perception, they see that the opportunity to use Chinese aid to facilitate economic growth and economic development inside the African countries as serving the purpose of better human rights in Africa. But that's Beijing's perception. I know many countries don't necessarily agree. Then on the issue of climate change, it has become an increasingly important topic in China's consideration of Africa. Like, for example, last month when Premier Li Keqiang visited Kenya, he emphasized that environmental issues and climate change is one of China's priority in its Africa policy. So we're expecting to see more out of China's activities in Africa on that aspect.
Yeah, the issue of natural resources exploitation and their being finite. We are Uganda, where I come from. We've discovered oil, and we are struggling with this debate. I think we can certainly use some assistance in making sure that we do a good job of regulating the industry. There is some possible threat to the natural parks where we found the oil, and we're trying to make sure we don't make any mistakes where we would have a disastrous impact. The oil is right on a major lake that feeds into the River Nile, so any catastrophe there would affect not only us but Sudan and Egypt. As for the utilization of these resources, we are debating for several years now on how to make sure that we use the resources wisely and make sure that they benefit future generations. And it's a big debate that's going on, and you're welcome to contribute to the debate. Thank you.
Sure. Let's see. We had a lot here, but starting off with the first question in terms of the U.S. approach to private sector engagement, I think what we've done is, I mean, obviously we have 12 U.S. government agencies and departments that are involved, all engage with the private sector in different ways. But at the end of the day, when we are engaging with each of the countries, it's actually the private sector that's coming to us with projects that they are engaged on, and we're looking at them in terms of what their overall impact is, how they fit in with the objectives of Power Africa are, and how catalytic they can be. And so in that sense, it's being driven a bit by the private sector in terms of our engagement. That said, our opportunities to engage there are somewhat balanced by the fact that it's not only the U.S. private sector that we're working with, but also the private sector in many of the respective countries. There are African firms that have committed resources, and roughly at this point, we have about $15 billion of commitment from private sector firms that have said that they want to be Power Africa partners. And so this includes financing firms, engineering firms, equipment suppliers, developers, and so I think that's one of the other things about what we're doing here is it's not just about U.S. firms, but it's also more broadly about firms both in Africa and other firms that are interested in investing in Africa more broadly. In terms of environmental protection issues, our colleagues at the State Department are engaged to an extent in Uganda and Mozambique in terms of natural resource management and we're engaged also in other countries that have recently discovered or are bringing online gas deposits. And some of the things we're trying to do there is work with countries to provide information and analysis on how to get some ideas on the policy side right early in the process as these resources come online. There are opportunities there to, before you get too far down the line, to get it right at the beginning rather than after a certain framework is put in place and certain interests have had a chance to engage or get entrenched. In terms of our work more broadly in environmental protection, that's a really important issue because that really feeds into the long-term sustainability of these projects. If they're not in line with the long-term environmental interests and the long-term social impact interests, the interests of the communities that we're working with, then in the long term, that it's going to be difficult to make that sustainable. And so we do want to make sure that the, as we engage in these communities and with these projects, whether they're larger or small, that they are taking environmental and the social impact considerations well into hand.
Regarding to the environment matter and also the climate change, Japan itself now we are in a very difficult situation after Fukushima disaster. But this morning session topic of the efficiency gap estimated by the $70 billion by the World Bank is raised. And we find this a good opportunity and some possibility for the mutual benefit realization between Japan and the sub-Saharan African country. Because energy-saving technology and green energy technology is one of our Japan's advantage, technical advantage. So the, we do hope find a good business model, collaborationship with African colleagues to such sort of the new technology in Africa and also in Japan simultaneously. That is our hope.
Right. Well, we've come to the end of our allotted time. And unfortunately, if I were to take another set of questions, we would greatly overrun our allotted time. So I think I'll have to draw this conversation to a close. I want to very much thank all four panelists who I think have offered us some really interesting and new insights into the relationship between Japan, the United States, and China in Africa. And I hope that AGI will continue to sponsor these conversations. Amadou, you're next.
Thank you. So I would like to introduce now our final speaker, last but not least. First, I would like to thank Ambassador Okamura from coming all the way to Japan and just coming from the airport. So thanks again. So Ambassador Yoshifumi Okamura is Director General for African Affairs at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan and the personal representative of the Prime Minister for Africa since September 2012. And Ambassador Okamura was in charge of convening TICAD 5, so the Tokyo International Conference on African Development, in last June at Yokohama, as Secretary General of the conference. So who is really well placed to speak about TICAD 5. He also has been in charge of the state visit of the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to African countries. You remember that the Prime Minister visited Cote d'Ivoire, Mozambique, and Ethiopia in January 2014. And he has a vast array of experience and deep knowledge on Africa through serving as ambassador of Japan to Cote d'Ivoire from 2008 to 2011 and covering Togo, Benin, Burkina Faso, and Niger. The only question you are not allowed to ask him is who is he rooting for, because Japan is playing Cote d'Ivoire tomorrow. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great, great honor for me to stand in this podium. To be invited to make some presentation on Japan's foreign policy towards Africa. I'm Director General, as was introduced, for Africa in foreign service, and I'm very happy Director General. Why? Because during my tenure, we had a TICAD. Not every Director General have that chance, you see, because TICAD is every 5 years, and tenure of the Director General is something like 2 years, 3 years. And also, I'm very happy Director General for Africa, because now everybody look at Africa with a very, very strong hope, and you see, the continent is no more the continent of despair, but really the continent of hope. And I'm a very happy Director General for Africa because I am invited by Brookings today. And it happens that this seminar is taking place shortly before the U.S. hosts the United States Africa Leaders Summit in August. So it is very, very opportune. And I really feel that if my comments prove at all informative in that context, I'll be more than happy. So I'm talking about TCAD. What is TCAD? Maybe my previous speakers already talked about TCAD, so I have no need. But I may make a short comment because TCAD, the mayor of Yokohama, came to me and say that I have to change TCAD into YCAD because the TCAD T should be a bit like that. Because nowadays that the TCAD, since 20, it started in 1993. It was in Tokyo, and every 5 years, this big event of inviting all the African leaders to Japan, and it was held in Tokyo. But last two times it is in Yokohama. But you see, the name of TCAD did so prevail. So we decided not to put TCAD into YCAD. But anyway, last June I planned and we did that last TCAD, TCAD 5, in June 2013. And 51 countries from Africa representing, and 39 African countries had sent the head of state level, so president, prime ministers, and vice president, and so on. And they say that the attendance is higher than at the annual African Union summit. Okay. Furthermore, the conference was held in Japan. You know that how many hours it takes from Africa to Japan? 20 hours, more than that. And it is really wonderful to see that all the heads of states flying from African continent to Japan, taking that pain and that energy. TCAD is just not a ceremony or just a festivity or the conference, but it is a really a process. I insist that this is a really long, very labor cumbersome process to reach at a document. So one document is declaration, which indicates a political orientation for the next coming 5 TCAD years. And another document is action plan. So what is important that this action plan make a specific program of development in order to realize what is declared in the declaration. So in order to arrive to that outcome document, numerous discussions was made to work things out. In the preparation of TCAD 5, we consciously chose not to have Japan to take the lead. So we had a very inclusive approach. We made preparation to broadly address the three areas of economy, society, and peace and stability. We put that robust and sustainable economy and inclusive and resilient society and peace and stability. Okay, come. Put anything that you wish to put. And this approach had make things, any pending issue can be fitted in somewhere. So we took the approach of letting African countries put forth as many issues and proposals for considerations as they wished. And this work had started with senior official level with senior officials meeting, SOM, we called it SOM, and then ministerial. The meeting was held in March, and then the summit level meeting in June. So it's a very, you see, long process that made things alive at summit level with declarations and declaration and action plan. This approach was acclaimed by the African participants as demonstrating Japan's willingness to listen to African views. That is as showing that Japan respects Africa's autonomy. However, there is some risk, danger. Indiscriminately permitting all issues to be presented would inevitably leave us with a sort of Christmas tree. Everything is in the tree. And furthermore, if contentious points of discussion, such as environmental issues, climate change dispute, that tense discussion that results could keep us from reaching a consensus. So this the risk and danger. So I'm a bit worried. But in the previous TIGAD, this worry proved needless. The vast majority of African countries were of one opinion. Okay, development assistance is very important. But now Africa needs is what they need is private sector trade and investment in one voice. Every single country claimed that. And also this meshed with the interests of the Japanese participants, as Japan's private companies continue to be strongly interested in Africa's potential as a resource supplier as well as a market. Both the African side, Japanese side, thus in agreement on the primary objective of bringing Japan and Africa via the private sector. So in TICAD 5, the private sector involvement is really an important issue. So anyway, the declaration converged on several priority items. I put on a handout in front of this room. So I ask you to read if you are interested. But in a very shortly, I explain you. The first thing is that private sector led economic growth should be promoted. And given the shortcomings in infrastructure and personnel, improving infrastructure and developing human resources are urgent needs. And next pillar is the farmers. The farmers, who make up the vast majority of the population, should be helped out of poverty through agricultural development. And that shifts our objective is the focus from farming to eat to farming to earn, to enrich the farmers. Last thing is, of course, the peace and stability, which is the base of all aspects of development. And Japan decided on its assistance measures based on these. Among the specific policies it advocated, we are formulating strategic master plans to improve infrastructure in 10 locations, establishing industrial human resource development center at 10 sites, and accepting 1,000 young trainees in Japan as part of, in the name of, Abe Initiative. Why Abe? African Business Education. Good, huh? Okay, there is some characteristics of TICAD. You see, the TICAD-alike partnership conferences are now everywhere. you see that China, not only the European Union's, some European countries, China, South Korea, India, Brazil, and quite recently Turkey is going to have this kind of partnership conference with Africa. The African heads of states are so busy visiting many partnership countries, including Japan. But for my point of view, Japan's ticket can be distinguished by several clear-cut characteristics. There's three points. First is ownership. The principle of ownership, this idea is already declared when the first TICAD was held in 1993, 20 years ago. African countries at that time had strong need of assistance, suffering from a business slump due to falling commodity product prices during the 1980s. On the other hand, the donors, dismantling of the communist bloc and other economic factors left donors little leeway to steer assistance funding to Africa. So in venturing to hold an aid conference with African countries in these circumstances, Japan declared, Africa must undertake self-help efforts and not just rely on assistance. Africa must take responsibility for properly utilizing any assistance fund that are forthcoming. Japan will offer its support for ideas generated by Africa itself. So this is ownership. Well, in Japan, the first thing that parents tell to their children, do it yourself. So this is the first step of the education. So this ownership seemed to be a rather cold and detached expression. However, the African participants welcomed this approach. Why? Well, it's my interpretation. Since the colonial era, Africans had been told that their ideas and ambitions were generally wrong, and they should do as they are told. It is historically background, because I really felt that while I was in Cote d'Ivoire. You see, the colonial powers' job to give and Africa to receive. The colonial powers' responsibility to teach and Africa to learn. But Japan asked self-help efforts. And this was interpreted as Japan having faith in the capability and potential of Africa. And this ownership concept is really a center pillar of TICAD. And we took that into a message of hand in hand. We are together, but we are equal. And you should not look at Japan simply a country of donor. And secondly, economic growth had been a leading topic. The traditional approach in discussing African development has been that of poverty reduction. And various international organizations have focused their attention and efforts on the negative dimensions of Africa, such as hunger, disease, illiteracy, child labor, corruption, HIV, etc., etc., and working to alleviate or eliminate these problems. And this is sort of very mainstream approach to talk about African development. But TICAD took these dimensions, of course. We have social aspects in one of the very important pillar. But our first thought was that achieving economic growth is more than important. Enriching people even a little will likely make the problem of poverty disappear naturally. Well, sometimes this growth-first approach is criticized by poverty reduction approach, because growth-first, saying that it only lead the economic interests of private companies. However, Japan was confident about its approach because we have experience in Asia. You see, that until the 1970s, even in 1980s, the countries of Asia themselves were suffering from poverty and wars and coup d'etat and some instabilities and insurgencies inside the country, etc., etc. But nowadays, these problems have almost more or less disappeared to a great extent. And we think that this attribute to the prosperity that people have come to enjoy through economic growth. And this economic growth, somewhat by official assistance from Japan, as well as expansion and investment by Japanese companies, relocalization of their production to Asia and so on, which Japan suffers a lot. But anyway, this prosperity has changed Asia a lot. And African countries have taken notice of that process. The role expected of TICAD is that of examining the factors underlying Asia's development and linking Asia's development to Africa's. And also they have, the African countries has their own reason, because the job creation is becoming a major issue in their internal politics. So within the TICAD, economic growth was put in a mainstream of that development issue. I have running out of time. Third, some political issues. How to handle the political issues. There are political disputes and even war ongoing between African countries. And if we were to take up specific disputes, the result will inevitably be conclusions favoring one party over the other. And TICAD become yet another arena for conflict. So there is an implicit understanding that we should seek to avoid this. This understanding allows even countries involved in disputes with each other to participate side by side in the TICAD conference. Nevertheless, we do actively address issues on which African countries can come to a consensus. For example, Sahel crisis and Somalia issues. Why? Because those are also the matter of keen interest of almost all the African countries. Counterterrorism, refugees issues, border control, law enforcement, etc., etc. So those issues that African countries confront in common, TICAD is dealing with them. And also, Japan and Africa are agreed on the need for UN Security Council reform. So we invariably discuss this as well. And also, we effectively working on issues such as democracy, governance, and rule of law. You may think that African countries are quite wary about discussing issues involving political values. And some suspicions about colonialism and interference in domestic affairs. Yes, more or less. But in TICAD, they are quite ready to talk about that. Even these issues come up for discussion. I believe Japan's standing as an Asian country that is not a former colonial Switzerland in the region offers a sense of reassurance of TICAD, and especially the empowerment of women. This is a very big issue in which African countries have expressed great interest. For its part, Japan has been giving priority to tackling women's issues in line with Prime Minister Abe's goal of a society in which women shine. Our view is that efforts are needed in Africa not only to improve women's livelihoods and rights, but also to involve women in the management of development projects and to support women entrepreneurs. Oh, thank you very much. Women are very, very important in Africa because the women are those people who knows how to manage, because they have homes, they have their household, they take care of children, they have to go to the market to buy things and sell things, and they can calculate and they prospect, while men just drink and dance. Okay. Fourth, TICAD is really a multi-meeting. And it is not bilateral at all. Japan is not the only chair, but we co-chair with Africa. And also, for organizing, Japan, as well as UN, World Bank, UNDP, and AUC, AUC is the African Union Commission. We are all together called co-organizers. Japan is one of co-organizers. And participation is not limited to African countries and Japan, but other countries of the region, anywhere, come to participate in TICAD. And international organizations, NGOs, observers, the TICAD is very open forum. And you may think that this conference makes debate among delegations of governments and international organizations. But I found TICAD is something more than that. The private companies, heads of states, come and talk, and in the margin of the conference, the bilateral talks are going on between different countries, and also the public is coming. In Yokohama last time, the more than 60,000 visitors came to join in a symposia or the trade show and other events. So it is a really a good, a big forum, or I can say opportunities for those people who are interested in Africa to join, get together to produce, to generate something. So this phenomena is make TICAD all the more appealing. So I talk about TICAD. So you may have the impression that TICAD is the whole and sum of Japan's foreign policy toward Africa. But this assessment would be quite mistaken. TICAD is certainly as an important tool in Japan's Africa's policy, but it is by no means the entirety of this policy. To the contrary, TCAT and our policy toward Africa has a conflict. Two approach is might be in conflict, and I sometimes find myself torn between these two approaches. I explain. TCAD calls on Africa as a whole, and what dominates is universalism. Maybe you may find another other English word, but what I want to say is that each of every 54 countries, African countries, should be treated as equal, one voice, see. And Japan's assistance measures must equitably benefit all of these countries. On the other hand, Japan's foreign policy toward Africa should be pushed forward according to Japan's own national interest. And we have very limited resources available for investment. Well, our policy of priority predominates. So universalism within the context of TCAT and priority issue within the context of Japan's foreign policy, that is sometimes in conflict. So it is a real area, sometimes it's an we need to think about it. But which countries, well, we don't want to select some of the countries which are very important for Japan and that these other countries are not. But we think about this priority thing according to the Japan's national policy. And what kind of policies most urgent need in Japan? Economic economic reconstruction. That Japan has been in stagnation for a long time, and Prime Minister Abe's priority of our politics is how to reconstruct Japan's economy. And so that Africans' growth should be somewhat linked to Japan's economic activity, so the business relation is very important. And there is a notable bias in the countries in which Japanese companies have set up local operations. If I talk about sub-Saharan Africa, the most notable expansion has been into southern and eastern Africa, particularly South Africa, which accounts 20 to 30% of sub-Saharan Africa's GNP, as well as Kenya and Tanzania. That part is really important for the Japanese business. In Western Africa, corporate interest is focused on two countries, Nigeria, a major market, and Ghana. Why Nigeria and Ghana? Because they speak English. And other countries are a bit. But now, a certain Japanese trading company had suddenly turned its attention to French-speaking West Africa. That Japanese trading company had purchased a French distribution company. And then now many people start thinking of the western part of French-speaking part of Western Africa. So Japanese firms feel a strong need for infrastructure improvement and human resource development in these countries. So they plead with the Japanese government to actively undertake development cooperation. Another priority is the natural resources. Japan needs also needs those natural resources, and that is a security related matter. From this perspective, Africa's resource potential is quite attractive. Priority is given to countries with energy resources. Close attention has been paid lately to Mozambique, where significant major natural gas reserves have begun to be tapped. Africa is now an important provider of several scarce resources essential for today's frontier industries. So those countries who produce those make a potential suppliers would be a priority. Third, there is some public opinion. Japanese public is very much interested in Djibouti and South Sudan. Why? Because we have this self-defense force dispatched there in order to offer concrete examples of Japan's contribution to global peace and stability through active, through constructive peace stability. And then other countries, some modalities of Japanese economic cooperation and levels of official and private exchange differ depending on long-standing friendly relations with Japan. And according to that also, we have some priorities. And so you may think about how to deal with this principle of universalism and the requirement of priority we live between them. Several significant attempts have been made to bridge these two requirements. First, I tell you that Prime Minister Abe had made a bilateral talk during the TICAD conference last year. And I hesitated to propose that to our Prime Minister, because there are 39 heads of state coming. And if Prime Minister had made all of them, to all of them, the bilateral meeting, how long it would take? But finally, he decided to do that. He allotted 20 minutes to each of 39 heads of state level delegations. You just calculate how long it took. But this placed quite a burden on the Prime Minister, but also make clear the policy of dealing with all countries without discrimination. The second is Prime Minister Abe's visit to Africa. You see that last year, the TICAD suggested that in addition to African leaders visiting Japan for TICAD meeting every 5 years, the Japanese Prime Minister should himself visit Africa. This is a claim made by African countries. Well, it is certainly the case that recent Japanese administrations have not been very long-lived. And in that consequence, no Japanese Prime Minister had visited Africa since 2006. In answer to this suggestion, Prime Minister Abe decided to visit three African countries in January of this year. Great. But problem is, which three countries? Well, okay, question of priority would say that, okay, we go to the very important countries that everybody regard as important. But this itinerary would give the impression that Japan only values those countries that can serve its own interest and which fly in the face of Chikad's universalism. After long and very careful deliberation, Prime Minister selected the three countries. In fact, I selected Cote d'Ivoire, Mozambique, and Ethiopia for the following reasons. First, they represent a regional balance. You see, the Cote d'Ivoire, maybe you are quite informed about the continent. So Cote d'Ivoire is in the west, and Mozambique in the south, and Ethiopia is in the east. So this is a well balanced. One problem is that Africa is so vast, and if go from one place to another, it is really a long flight. But nevertheless, we selected those very big itinerary. Next, balance of messages. The first message is the Prime Minister visits French-speaking Western African country, which is Cote d'Ivoire. And second message, that we are very much interested in business opportunities in Mozambique. And then finally, Ethiopia is political, because Ethiopia is, Addis Ababa is located by AU Commission, the big building. And to make a keynote speech from the podium of African Union's room is meant to address all the continent. So this is a balance of messages. And especially in Cote d'Ivoire, where I was ambassador, not because I was ambassador, Cote d'Ivoire was mentioned, but it is representing the visiting the West Africa. And at that time, Cote d'Ivoire was the chairmanship of ECOWAS. So Prime Minister asked the President Alassane Ouattara, in fact, I asked him, to invite the leaders of ECOWAS countries. And to my surprise, there are 10 countries took the trouble to fly there. Even the Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria came to Abidjan to meet our Prime Minister. And so it's really a good presentation that Prime Minister is not just visiting one country, but in the visiting the region. And finally, those three countries are relatively mid-sized, you see. If a Prime Minister visited big country like South Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, what else? Well, they say, okay, Japan is selecting. But you see that many people were no doubt surprised by the selection of three mid-sized countries. Another attempt to bridge universalism and priority thing is that the idea of regionality, distinct from our approach of providing economic cooperation to individual countries, we consider economic cooperation in terms of projects spanning multiple countries in a given region. There are, in fact, good reasons. You see that relatively, African countries are small-sized because they inherited the colonial demarcation. But in the modern economic activity, that regional integration is required to make the market bigger. Okay, so strategic master plan or corridor concept or one-stop border issues is very important to stop to facilitate inter-regional transport. And so a regional aspect is how is a very good way to bridge this one particular country's concept to this universalism. And in last year's UN General Assembly, Prime Minister Abe contacted the leaders of the chair countries of seven regional organizations like SADC, ECOWAS, EAC, COMESA, etc., etc., and arranged a Japan-REC summit meeting. And we talk about the prime minister and presidents of each of chair country of region RECs talked about agriculture. And this hopefully served to send a message that Japan values regional organizations. So may I think a lady say that, stop. Okay. I stop. But conclusion is that, you see, that Japan and Africa is now having many things, although very long distance separates the two areas. But both Africa and Japan share quite a few common agenda. So the key to Japan's Africa policy will be to accurately identify these agenda and tie them together. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Kimura. That was really quite a comprehensive and very, very insightful description of TICAD and Japan's foreign policy in Africa, and I think it was really interesting to talk about the universalism versus the need for attaching priorities and how you actually strike a balance between those two needs of Japan's approach to Africa. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of our time. We actually went over time, and the room is needed, so we are going to have to stop. And I want to thank again on behalf of my colleague Amadusi and myself all the panelists for excellent presentations, Ambassador Kimura for a wonderful keynote, and all of you for joining us today. Thank you so much.